Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another. Today's episode is a rebroadcast of a virtual event at the Center on National Security.
And you're a refugee and you don't have food and you don't feel secure and you don't feel protected. You look at the Qaeda guys, or you look at the Houthis, Ansarullah, or you look at whoever you look at, and they're going to be your heroes. They're going to be your saviors. You're going to be recruited. You're going to be an extremist. I think, frankly, I'm really surprised that we don't have more kids that's recruited by these organizations. And that has a lot to do with, their families, their upbringing, the culture that they are in, that's preventing many people from being recruited. But even if you recruit 1% or 2% of the millions of people who are refugees all across the Muslim world, that is going to create a huge disaster down the road. And we need to pay attention to this. I go back to the situation with Al-Hol. Thousands and thousands of people, 10,000 fighters, those are not in Al-Hol. Those are different camps. But the families, the children, many are Westerns and Europeans. And the Europeans are not taking back their citizens. What's going to happen to them when they are released? What's going to happen to that kid when went to Al-Hol 5-6 years ago, and he was 10 and now he's 15 or 16 years old? What kind of citizen do you think he's going to be? He's citizen only to one and one state that doesn't exist, called ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. So we need to pay attention to this. And I think, again, we can ignore all these problems, but I can guarantee you down the road, we're going to pay a heavy price for ignoring these problems. They cost less now to deal with them than they're going to cost down the road. And if you don't remember, if you forget about 9/11, remember it again.
John, I'm going to bunch up a couple of questions here on Russia and go to you, John, for this. One is Alexander Cohn. The latest threat of Russian invasion is very different from the covert hybrid warfare approach of the 2014 incursion. Does that suggest it's strategic saber rattling now? And another one, which is, from Mike Jankiewicz, to what extent does the Ukrainian operation have to do with Putin's domestic problems? And so either one of those or both of those that you can comment on. A lot of experts have raised the sort of, Russia's running out of money, right? Russia's spread too thin. What's happening with Russia domestically? Your thoughts?
Well, it might be an effort to divert, but I think even if it has the short-term benefit of maybe diverting attention, I think it is long-term problematic for Putin for the reasons we talked about. These financial sanctions, talking about if Russia is not able to participate basically in the international financial environment, I mean, that's going to be really, really costly. And Nord Stream 2, will absolutely be dead. There are other things that I think is going to really hurt a lot of Russians. And then also just the body bags that are coming back. So I don't think it's a very good way to address any of those domestic problems. I do think that, Putin has a number of challenges that he needs to address, but unfortunately, I don't think this is the right way to do it. What he's doing right now is much different than what happened in 2014, when he was sending those little green men across the border and engaging in these paramilitary and covert operations. I do think there's a fair amount of saber rattling. Some Russians saying that this finally is getting the attention of the West. And so maybe Putin is going to package this that it was only with the threat of invasion was NATO and the United States able to provide some type of reassurance that there's not going to be this westward march? You know, and this is really a fabricated crisis, you know, that Putin is claiming, because there's no intention that Ukraine is going to join NATO in the near term at all. Yes, I know that people and Ukrainian officials have said that is, you know, their true ambition, but there is nothing right now on NATO's agenda to do that. And I think they would avoid that because they know that would be very provocative at this point. So yes, this is different. But again, I think both Ali and I were saying that, you know, maybe Putin miscalculated a bit, or he's recalculating now, taking into account the various reactions to that saber-rattling.
A couple of questions have come in about the JCPOA. And, you know, these talks have been on again, off again. They seem to be taking forever. Like Ukraine, we don't really know which direction they're headed. I'd like to know from both of you, kind of in answering these questions in the sort of aggregate, what do you see as the chances for this deal being made in the near future? And how important is it that the deal get remade? Ali, let's start with you.
Well, frankly, it's all up to the Iranians. I mean, definitely, you know, we want to have a deal. We have already had a deal with them before President Trump stopped it, but they want to go back to the situation as it was when we had a deal with them at the first time. Well, during the time period when President Trump exited that deal, they did a lot of things, but they don't want to count any of these kind of things in the new agreement. And I think it is very, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, the Biden administration really want to win. Well, not really, because if they wanted to win, they could have had the deal already. But I think we want the right deal with Iran, a deal that can, enhance global security, regional security, take into account our allies and our friends in the region. It's up to the Iranians. I believe the Iranians probably know that this is an opportunity for them. And I think at the bottom line, it's only fair to basically discuss all the bad things that they did. I mean, I'm calling it bad things, but you know what I mean? All the nuclear development or the technological advances that they did in the years when they were out of the JCPO. We need to go back to that as well.
John, you agree with that, or you want to add anything? Or
I'm whether I should be or not, I'm optimistic that within the next few months, maybe even shorter than that, that there's going to be some type of return. But as Ali says, we have to take into account what has happened over the last several years. No deal with Iran is going to be perfect, and it's not going to meet all of the requirements of people, including in Congress. But the last thing we want, I think, is for Iran to continue this march toward nuclear weapons development, increasing stockpiles, increasing centrifuge production of fissile material. And so I think it's going to be a continued negotiations, but I am hoping that some recent indicators suggest that the Iranians are more amenable now to a new deal.
John, let me just ask you a final question, and then I'll ask Ali. The pivot to Asia, where we got through this whole hour and never really talked about the pivot to Asia. What do you see as the future evolution of this sort of brewing confrontation between the United States and China? What signposts can we look for? What concerns should we have? How do you envision the future?
Well, I think it's going to be a challenging one, because China continues its global march, and Xi Jinping and Chinese leaders have been very strategic, and they have not been beset by real domestic political cycles. And so they've been able to maintain this Belt and Road Initiative over time. Later this year, there's going to be the Chinese Party Congress meeting, where I guess Xi Jinping will be reelected, and, you know, because term limits now have been removed. So there are areas of real concern, and I'm not just talking on the trade front, I'm talking about the Chinese influence, not just in the region of East Asia and Southeast Asia, but also across South Asia and into Africa. A lot of their commercial, trade, and business activities are being undergirded by military-based development, security intelligence ties, and other things. And so they are patient, they're strategic, and I think they are determined. And so I do think that the Biden administration is very serious about trying to address the totality of the Chinese challenge. There are areas where we can, in fact, deconflict, areas maybe we can coordinate or collaborate. But I think there's going to be a fair amount of tension in some of these areas, particularly when it comes to technology and it comes to some of the issues that I think China is posing a serious threat, not just to ourselves, but also to our allies and partners around the globe.
Ali, how would you see, and this is the final question, how do you see the pivot to Asia as it's referred to, and in particular in its intersection with global terrorism and the threat of global terrorism?
Okay, I agree with what John mentioned, and I think we lost a few years. We started the pivot to Asia under the Obama administration, actually a little bit also before. And I think we just looked the other way, thinking the problem is going to go away. And we have a lot of allies, at least 11 countries in the region, that want that strategic American leadership in the region, want a strategic anchor for the United States in the region. And I think it is important for all the reasons that John mentioned to do so. But also at the same time, I think China, I'm doing a lot of the stuff that John brilliantly mentioned. But also at the same time, if you see their alliances now in Central Asia, for example, it's all alliances based on counterterrorism. They are trying to use our strategy in building counterterrorism relationships with other countries to protect the Road and Belt Initiative. I think they have been benefiting from the international system that the United States led and established and protected. And I think it is time to, started to hold them accountable and challenge the influence that they are trying to do in threatening their neighbors and threatening countries around them. And that's what Pivot to Asia was all about until we, like the Iran deal, we pulled out of it. Jenny, now we're trying to catch up.
Yeah, we're out of time. I learned a lot. I hope our listeners and watchers learned a lot. Let's try to do this again. Let's not wait 3 years, and let's try to do it in person if possible. But thank you both so much for being willing to guide us all through these current times. We will see you all of you next time. Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interest online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.